today with Katrina Shanklin, who is currently a representative on the State Assembly, but she is this time running for the 3rd congressional seat in the state. And so you are up against two other candidates in the Democratic Party, and then all three of you are vying to go and head-to-head with Derek Van Orden. How is your campaign going? You've been in Richland Center quite often lately.
Thanks. I've been really enjoying coming back here. It's a beautiful area, and it's wonderful to see people I met previously and then also meet new ones. We were just at Kelly's and had a great coffee. I have been really enjoying getting all across the 3rd Congressional District. It's a huge district, 19 counties that covers western and central Wisconsin. And so I have been all over every single week trying to get to not only new places I haven't been yet, but come back repeatedly to other larger areas like Richland Center. And by larger, this is such a rural district that Richland Center is one of the larger cities. And I think that really speaks to the need to have somebody who understands rural communities. I grew up in a small town of 1,000, and I represent a pretty rural district in central Wisconsin. And now I'm running for Congress because I want to ensure that we have a strong voice in Congress who is really focused on delivering common sense solutions and results for western and central Wisconsin.
So around here, you know, a lot of our issues are school funding. We've had schools go to referendum. One school district recently passed a referendum. Another school failed. We've got another school that's going to referendum in August. We have another school that failed in this last fall, and they're going to go to referendum again in April. And it's like referendum after referendum after referendum. How do you see an improvement for education so that schools aren't always having to go to referendum?
Thank you so much for this great question. I am actually about to release a new TV ad specifically on public education. And in it, I talk about two things: funding our public education so we don't have to over rely on property taxes, which is what those referenda are for, to raise the levy, which increases property taxes, as well as supporting teachers with raising teacher pay. And here's how we can do it. So here in Wisconsin, we have shared revenue on the state level that goes to local communities. A lot of local communities are actually going to referendum on police, fire, and EMS, and shared revenue was going to help that, and it did to an extent, but I think we need even more shared revenue on that level so that we can hold the line on property taxes. But as it relates to school districts and holding the line on property taxes, we need more state and federal support. And so one of my ideas that I have is a new program on the federal level to reward states that invest in their public schools and invest less in those private voucher schools that are really taking directly from the pot of taxpayer money in our local public school district. And then another program to raise teacher pay. So providing that support directly from the federal government and sending it to states that will then deliver it to their local school districts. So that way we're not, as property taxpayers, homeowners and renters alike, being given the bill every year, 2 years, 3 years. There's lots of rural school districts especially that are really struggling and looking at consolidation. And that's a concern for me as somebody who did grow up in a very geographically huge small school district, Wittenberg-Burnhamwood, where, you know, a lot of kids had to ride the bus for at least a half hour. And that was years and years ago. Now I'm hearing, especially as I travel across the third, there's a lot of people who are looking at an hour or more as sparsely populated areas are looking at, you know, shutting down some of their schools and consolidating with others. So we can do more for public education. It's the cornerstone of every community. And I believe that we need an all of government approach, working with local, state, and federal leaders. So in Congress, that's what I'll do to raise teacher pay and invest in our public schools so we don't have to raise our property taxes.
Do you see some of that trickling down then into child care facilities? Richland County actually is a child care desert. And, you know, and if you don't have child care, then you can't go to work, which deteriorates then your job markets. And those kids are eventually going to be going into school too, you know. So it's kind of a all in one thing, you know, one umbrella. That how do we take care of our kids of today?
I could not agree with you more. And when I talk about education, I not only bring up K-12 public schools and pre-K and child care, but also higher education, technical colleges and universities, because it is making sure that they have the best possible future. And our child care providers are skilled in early childhood education, and they're really preparing our kids with those soft skills, understanding how to regulate their feelings and describe them instead of not using their words, right? And emotional management, in addition to all the other kind of hard skills like saying please and thank you and washing your hands and tying your shoes, right? And I think that's really important because when it comes to child care and child care deserts in Wisconsin, we have a lot of work to do. There was a program on the state level called Child Care Counts, and that is going to expire in about a year's time. And, you know, 40% of child care providers would have had to either raise tuition, raise costs on working families, or close their doors altogether without that program. So we need our state lawmakers to listen to the calls from child care providers to reauthorize that program. But I also know there are federal child tax credits that are important to making child care more affordable, but we can do even more to make child care as accessible as possible by supporting our child care providers. As you said, if you don't even have child care in your community to the extent that it becomes a desert, you're actually opting, in some cases, opting out of the workforce or maybe not working the same number of hours you want, or even maybe not taking a promotion you're eligible for because you don't have that child care. So this is an economic issue and a workforce issue too.
Well, another economic issue, and you brought it up, is higher education. Richland was the first campus to close in the UW system. And it's not even UW system schools that are continuing to close. There's private colleges, and that affects the community that that college is in, and their revenue decreases. Richland County's revenue has dropped tremendously since the campus has closed. How do you see being able to help those communities that are suffering in that way?
Absolutely. I think first and foremost, it's important to recognize that there was never a vote of the state legislature or governor to close these campuses down. And that's a problem. I was very concerned when the 2 and 4 year campuses were merged years ago and said this is going to lead to the closures. And I've been speaking out as a state lawmaker who serves on the Colleges and Universities Committee about the way that these smaller campuses, especially 2 year campuses, fulfill so many needs of area high school students who are looking at higher education but aren't quite sure which 4 year they'd like to go to. And those 2 year campuses are a great access point that are incredibly affordable and have amazing educators. I personally went to a 2 year campus, UW-Marathon County in Wausau, before heading on to a 4 year campus. And I think that my experience was instrumental in helping me and shaping my skill set and my education. And I am lamenting for Richland Center area folks who no longer have that option. And also am very frustrated that the economic impact, the hit to the community, isn't just a one-time thing like some state lawmakers might have implied. It's forever. It's generational, potentially. It's the same as a manufacturing facility shutting down and leaving the state or country. It has a massive impact on your future workforce, your community members. Some have moved away altogether, I've heard. And that really concerns me because communities like Richland Center are special places where they deserve investment too. We were at a forum in Muscadet as a lawmaker. I attended and spoke at a forum on the future of higher education. And former Senator Dale Schultz said there, I'll never forget his words, rural people deserve nice things too. I've said it so many times since. He's 100% right. Your zip code, living in a rural area, shouldn't prevent you from having the same things that everyone else has: access to childcare, clean water, broadband, a good job that pays well, healthcare. And when it comes to higher education, a technical college or local 2 or 4 year campus as well. And so for this area and all of Western Wisconsin, I want to be a champion on this issue. And I think on the federal level, we need to look at access points, not only for higher education, but I had a listening center in Richland Center a couple months ago, And we talked about healthcare access points too. That's another one where, you know, providers' doors are closing, and the federal government has a lot to do with that related to reimbursement rates, as well as the state government and Medicaid. So I want to work on those issues because, as Dale Schultz says, rural people deserve nice things too, and we have to make it happen.
And I think it's important too that, you know, with, like you brought up, Medicaid and Medicare, and I'm on Medicare. I went to the doctor and I got my bill and it said I owed $240. My Medicare had always been, my portion was $200. And when I went, and they said, no, it went up to $240. I don't remember getting any letter about it going up. You know, there needs to be more, it needs to be more transparent.
Thank you for sharing that. And I agree completely. One of the conversations I had recently on the trail, somebody brought up surprise medical bills and hidden healthcare costs. And there was a provision in the Affordable Care Act that was supposed to have hospitals actually listing all the different costs so people have transparency. I think we need a little bit stronger laws related to that because it's still not working out in terms of transparency as it was intended to. But in addition to that, we need accountability and transparency in all medical billing and in pricing. And I think that means, you know, when it comes to health insurance companies and the middleman, in addition to providers, we need to ensure that our federal programs like Medicaid and Medicare are not only holding the line on those rising costs, but that we're fairly funding the providers too, so their doors stay open. So I appreciate you sharing that.
What really gets me too is as you get older, it's harder because you got to watch all these hoops. You're more of your own advocate when you're younger and you have a job. For the most part, you're covered under your employer. And now as you're getting older and more forgetful, let's face it, you know, not everybody, but I'll put myself in that place of, and you got to be your own advocate. And you don't understand all these things. There's got to be a way to make it easier so that as you age, you're not worried about, did you make the right decision? And then find out later that you don't have the right insurance for what you need.
That's such a great point. And insurance is already very difficult to navigate. We shouldn't be making it any harder. And, you know, when it comes to surprise medical bills or just helping people navigate from a consumer protection point, their bills, I've handled a lot of those, what we call constituent cases on the state level. A lot of people aren't aware that you can call your state lawmaker's office and say, hey, I have a problem with this medical bill. Can you help me either contact this healthcare provider directly or in some cases file a complaint with the Office of Commissioner of Insurance if it's related to insurance? And we've helped a lot of different constituents with that because it has been so difficult. And, you know, no one's going to have all the answers to making it easier, but we need a task force to help with not only consumer protection, but transparency as it relates to healthcare costs. And one of the things I talk about a lot on the campaign trail is the rising costs of healthcare and prescription medicine and how we need to tackle those issues. And I'm really proud that in the legislature, we've been able to get some things done on that, specifically cracking down on pharmacy benefit managers, the middleman between insurance companies and pharmacies. There used to be what's called a gag clause, so that if you were going to the pharmacy with your prescription and picking up a drug and it wasn't generic and there wasn't a more affordable price, a pharmacist could actually not tell you. They were gagged from saying, hey, there's actually a similar equivalent for you that would be $50 or $500 less. And now they can. And so we need to eliminate some of that, all of that red tape, and just help consumers not only with lower costs, but having that transparency and accountability.
You know, as we've talked about school, which is the younger generation. We've talked about Medicare, which is the older generation, and we've talked about higher education, the middle generation. That is one thing about politics. You have to cover all generations and all genres, don't you?
Absolutely. And I think what I enjoy most about politics is the opportunity to meet people where they're at and hear from them. Today at Kelly's, I heard from a number of parents who wanted to talk about their kids or their loved ones and really talk about issues really important to them, whether it was healthcare or equality. And I found that really moving. I remember people's stories. And when I see a bill that I want to put my name on because of a constituent that I met, it really shows that you have a lot of power when you share your stories with elected officials. And on the campaign trail, you have a lot of power when you see candidates come to town and speak, and you can ask lots of questions. We had a great conversation today about ending Citizens United, getting big corporate money out of politics so voters have the power. And what I'm telling everyone in the 3rd Congressional District is their voice matters. We're in the number one swing district and the number one swing state, and we have so much power to not only decide, you know, what the makeup of the House looks like, but also it's, you know, a lot of the votes for both the White House and Senate are going to come for Wisconsin, I should say, are going to come through the 3rd. It's a perfect swing district in many respects. And I think that the civic participation I've seen not only here, but all over Western and Central Wisconsin is really inspiring to me.
Well, I think people are realizing that even though all they get is one vote, that one vote is very important and they have a voice.
Absolutely. Well said. People understand that when they vote, they can shape their future. You know, the policies, whether it's the local level, what garbage removal and snow removal and infrastructure, or whether it's state level, like public education and water quality, or whether it's federal level, like Social Security and Medicare and the Farm Bill, your vote really determines what's going to happen. And people want elected officials who show up and listen and lead on the issues that matter to them. And that's why I'm here. My number one goal in this campaign is to listen to voters and really respond to their needs and interests and hopefully get elected to become their champion in Congress.
Well, some of the other topics, and you've brought them up, is infrastructure. And coming in, you drove down Highway 14, which is a U.S. highway, and it's in terrible shape. I mean, you probably felt like you were on a railroad track.
You know, I appreciate you mentioning that. Yeah, infrastructure is important, and road funding is definitely an issue. In my time in the legislature, we've had a lot of disagreement about how to fund our roads. Voters are, I would say, divided isn't the word, but they have many different ideas about how to sustainably and fairly fund roads, right? And I think because of that, because of the differences of an opinion, it took a while to find a good kind of thoughtful way forward on getting our roads fixed. But I give Governor Evers a lot of credit. He's gotten a lot done on that over the last few years. But, you know, with tough winters and sometimes there's overuse of certain roads, I think that we can be creative on, you know, how to not only fix our roads, but also do it in a way that benefits rural communities. So one bill that I want to mention that I co-sponsored that I'm really proud of that we got done this session is the Agricultural Road Improvement Program. Several $100 million is being distributed across the state to communities that apply, specifically if a road in their community is a primarily agricultural road, meaning, you know, this is the best place to get your goods to market, or it will save the farmer on a certain number of trips or lower the weight of things. And so I think that that's incredible. It's the first time we sent money specifically to agricultural roads. And I think that's a great idea to bring to Congress as well.
How do you see the dollars coming for funding? More funding for infrastructure.
So there are two bills that Congress passed last session, the bipartisan infrastructure law and then the Inflation Reduction Act, that I think are both really important for infrastructure. Bipartisan infrastructure law brought a lot of money in for water, including sewer infrastructure, for example, water utility infrastructure and clean drinking water. So there are places in the 3rd with PFAS contamination that are getting some of that money now because of that. And I think that's really helpful because I believe everyone deserves to drink water from their taps. The Inflation Reduction Act brought even more money in for infrastructure, including EV car charging infrastructure. Our state just got $78 million after we passed a bipartisan bill to leverage that. that federal funding, and that will help some folks, but we also have to focus on, you know, road funding and broadband too. And so I, as a lawmaker who is kind of seen behind the curtain of, you know, how these funding fights for infrastructure can be, I know that, you know, there's sometimes a rural versus urban divide among politicians. It might not be Democrat versus Republican. It might be, you know, what kind of community you represent. I, as a member of Congress, should I get there, would be very focused on making sure that when we pass big infrastructure bills, they actually come back home to us, and that we're getting them in the tiniest, those dollars for roads and for water quality in those tiniest towns and villages, and not just the largest cities.
Now, you know, it seems one of the things that seem to be a constant battle in Washington is the Farm Bill. How do you feel about the Farm Bill?
Yeah, the Farm Bill is incredibly important. I think it's one of the most important votes that members of Congress take, because for farmers, it is crucial for their economic security, and for them getting their crops to market and harvesting, and for dairy farmers, of course, and their exports. And it's also important for food security. So there's been a coalition for decades of Democrats and Republicans who vote for the Farm Bill, because it doesn't just support farmers, but it also feeds families and seniors. And that coalition broke this year. The Farm Bill's almost a full year late. The deadline was last September 30th. The Congress extended it to this September 30th, and it passed the House. And I criticized Eric Van Orden for two things. One, the SNAP benefits, the food share that helps people afford, you know, food to put on the table, didn't keep up with inflation over the next 5 years. So you'll get the same amount of money, but less food as a result. And that $28 billion was really important to a lot of people. But it wasn't just the cuts, it's that it broke the coalition. So Senate Democrats have already said, we're not passing that version of the bill. And so what I'm worried about is the Farm Bill not getting done at all. And what does that mean? More uncertainty for farmers at a time, you know, input costs are difficult, and they need to ensure that they have the security of, you know, not only pricing, but what if there will be a Farm Bill, what that looks like. And so in addition to that, he had, there's a really important program called the Dairy Innovation Grant. And Derek Van Orden introduced an amendment after his own party had gutted the bill or the grant by 40%. On the Agriculture Committee, he introduced the amendment, but he didn't call for a vote. So it was kind of symbolic. He said, well, I would like this, but he has the majority in his caucus, and he withdrew it, which means they never took a vote on it, and he could have passed that. So I know, you know, I talked to him about this in person when I saw him in my assembly district, that I was disappointed on that, because when it comes to getting things done, we need members of Congress who are going to usher, you know, the bill through every single step. It isn't just about getting it through the House. We need to make sure it goes through the Senate and on to the president. And as a lawmaker who's done that, who I've sat down with members of the Senate Republican caucus to negotiate on a PFAS bill, as one example, that I don't view my job as just going and voting on a bill and then calling it a day, or introducing an amendment but not getting a vote on it. I view it as ushering every part of the policy that I want done through the legislative process until it's signed into law. And then afterwards, as it's implemented, making sure my constituents get the benefits from that law. And so when it comes to the Farm Bill, A, we need it immediately. And B, it needs to be fair. It needs to support working families and seniors with food security. It also needs to center farmers and ensure that they have everything they need to be successful.
You know, we've covered several topics that are important for Southwest Wisconsin. We're an agricultural community. We're an elderly community in Richland Center, yet we are getting younger families in, so education is important. And the RNC just finished up, and we all saw that went. But the DNC is coming up. What do you hope people get out of the DNC?
That's a great question. And as I've been traveling on the trail, I have to say I haven't thought that much about the DNC yet. But here's what I'll say. I hope that people see a contrast. I think in any election, there should be, you know, every candidate has to say, here's what I stand for and why me? You know, if you ask a voter for their vote, you have to be able to answer why you. And so I hope that that's articulated very clearly, and a vision for our future is important. My two issues that I've been talking about the most on the trail are democracy and freedom, because everything else follows. If you have a healthy democracy where your vote is counted and there's trust in that election and people aren't working to undermine that election or overturn it, that's important and key to civic participation and engagement. And then freedom, the freedom to make your own medical decisions, the freedom to breathe clean air and drink clean water. I think those are important too. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about contraception, IVF, you know, the ability to start a family when you want to, and abortion. And that's been really important to voters of all political ideologies, not just Democrats. And so I hope to see at the DNC, Democrats really leading on democracy and freedom and showing that stark contrast. I've been hearing a lot from folks on the trail about Project 2025. It's a 900-page document. I'm still certainly going through it. But what I know is I'm concerned about the reshaping of our country and not only what the federal government would look like, but the lack of, you know, environmental protections, public education, workers' rights, access to health care. I'll mention, you know, surveillance for women seeking medical care is one that really disturbed me. But we've been talking about it because it shows that's their agenda and that's what we're seeing down the road. What I want Democrats to do at the DNC is show, here's our positive vision, here's our agenda, and it needs to center democracy and freedom.
Now, you brought up several things that you'd like to accomplish if you're elected, but if there's a Republican president, how do you see being able to work with that situation?
Sure. So I've done this before. I've always served in the minority and in the legislature, and I've served under a Republican governor and a Democratic governor. And I'm really proud to report that even when I didn't have the votes in the Assembly or the Senate in my own party or with the governor, who was a Republican when I was first elected, I still got bills passed, whether it was we actually made it easier for people with disabilities to get meaningful employment in Wisconsin. Wisconsin became a national leader, and I worked with Democrats and Republicans to make that happen. And the then Governor Walker signed it into law. So that's one example of a bill that I passed and led with former Senator Jennifer Schilling from the La Crosse area on when I was what's called a freshman. It's just like high school, right? So when you're first elected, they call you a freshman. If I were a freshman in Congress, here's what I do. I would work with anyone and everyone who is serious about getting things done for the issues that keep the people of Wisconsin up at night, whether it's lowering healthcare and prescription drug costs or ending Citizens United to get big money out of politics. Whoever's serious about it, let's get it done. One of the things that I do as a Democrat who does work with both parties is I sit down with lawmakers and I say, hey, what interests you? What can we work on together? And I bring a menu of options of my goals and see if we can work together and negotiate. And, you know, I mentioned Project 2025. We're not going to negotiate on that. I oppose it. But if it comes to, you know, supporting farmers and passing a fair farm bill that works for them, let's do it. And if it comes to making healthcare more accessible and more affordable, let's do it. And protecting Social Security and Medicare, that's one of my priorities. And making public education fairly funded at all levels, including early childhood education and higher ed, absolutely. So that's really my stance is if they're serious about working together, I'm on board because I want to deliver results. And that's the number one job of any elected official.
Well, I thank you, Katrina, for coming in today and taking the time to talk with us about these important issues that are facing Richland County and the surrounding area.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. And if people have more questions and would like to chat or ask me anything, you can go to KatrinaShankland for Congress.com.
All right. Well, you take care and safe travels.
Thank you.